I-70 was going to come across the great state of Kansas and dead end into Denver.
Today on KPR Presents, we take a look at the highways that crisscross our state and our country. I'm Kay McIntyre. We'll also visit with relationship expert Harriet Lerner on the art of the apology and why it's so hard to get it right. Finally, a conversation with Elizabeth Farnsworth of Public Television's NewsHour. She's the author of a new memoir, A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined. But first, Dan McNichol is the author of The Roads That Built America, The Incredible Story of the U.S. Interstate System. In this encore broadcast, McNichol says that although President Dwight D. Eisenhower is rightly credited with creating the interstate highway system, the idea goes all the way back to George Washington.
I find it fascinating. Here you have these two generals of note, these two American heroes, and when they become the president of the United States, each one of them turned to roads as the solution to keep the country safe and to keep it together. Eisenhower, with the now famous and sometimes infamous interstate system, it's called the Dwight D. Eisenhower system of the National System of Interstate and Defense Highways. It's right there in the name. And Washington laid out the National Road. It wasn't called that when he was laying it out. It was Nieman Colin's Trail, an Indian trail that turned into his fruits of progress and fortune, this famous road for the Delaware Company to go out and get furs and materials. And Eisenhower and Washington both obsessed about building the roads because it was a matter of homeland security when you come right down to it.
You mentioned that that first national road was based on an Indian trail. To what extent do our nation's highways mimic or parallel old Native American trails?
You know, there's so much feng shui inside of roads. These are desire lines. These are lines that have been explored since ancient times, and we just keep laying down new forms of transportation along them. So the first trails were Indian trails. The Indians were hunting, and as they were chasing wild game, they beat down a familiar path. Washington followed that as a young man building his fortunes. He followed that into the West, the Great West being Ohio at the time, not Kansas, not California. And that was his way of trade. But I think as a man who literally laid out the road and followed that road and risked his own life on that road, George Washington, he knew that this path, this desire line out west, was the logical road to build the next generation of travel on. And that looked like a wider path, a smooth path. They took out the trees, and stagecoaches were soon running oysters into the Ohio lands, fresh enough that people could eat. That was remarkable at the time.
So let's jump forward into the 1950s, when President Dwight Eisenhower looks at the nation and says, we really need an interstate highway system. What was the direct impetus for him to do so?
Eisenhower was looking at this as the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, as the best way to keep the country profitable, safe, and defended. He knew that there was so much loss of life along these roads. They called U.S. Route 66 Bloody 66 because there were so many head-ons. And with a divided highway, the travel was so much safer, and he knew that. And he said this over and over again in his State of the Union addresses. He was a brilliant campaigner. He branded this idea, and he pushed it out, and he relentlessly, through his first entire administration, campaigned to get this road built through the State of the Union often. And then he also said, you know, commerce. We are stuck in traffic, and if we can buckle ourselves from that congestion, we will profit. And then lastly, he knew during the nuclear age, it was very important to be able to diversify, to spread out our defense factories and important defense locations. And we did that eventually through what we call urban sprawl now, but we moved out to the suburbs and we were able to spread ourselves out. He also obsessed, especially in 1955, made more entries in his diary then about nuclear holocaust than ever, but he was very, very concerned about after a nuclear strike, what would happen. And the rebuilding, he thought, and the rescue and rebuilding would all take place along the interstate system.
And President Eisenhower had some firsthand experience with just how bad the roads were in terms of getting from one part of the country to another, dating back to his experience in World War One.
Even earlier back in Kansas, he moved as a child to Abilene, and the Chisholm Trails at the right there ends. It comes up from Texas, and it was a movement of cattle. But he knew that this movement that needed to take place over the road for the military especially was going to help, one, the economy, and two, the military. There's this constant back and forth between the two. The stronger the road, the better the economy, the more strong we are as a nation with a defensive network. And the better the defensive network we have, the more we can depend on that road that we build for our economy. So it goes back and forth, and he knew that anything he built, and he later warned us against it, the military-industrial complex. But he built up that military-industrial complex for World War II, and he knew how important the road system would be for factories, for workers, for shipping supplies, not for marching troops down, but for just moving the economy along to mobilize.
One of the things that you say in your book, The Roads That Built America, is that the genius of the interstate system is in its uniformity. What do you mean by that?
Well, thank you for reading it. And thanks. It took me a while to stumble upon this obvious note. But, you know, it's people complain all the time about how banal the roads are on the interstate system and how boring it is. But it's designed to be boring. It's designed to be predictable. It's designed to keep you alive. It was often the case when you'd be storming down a road. You could be on the Pennsylvania Turnpike in the 1940s, and then suddenly the road would come to an end. Or you come around a corner and the road size would change, the pavement would change. And those kind of sudden changes in surface can be deadly. The idea of this interstate system is you know it. You know it where if you're in Washington State or in Florida or in California, it's all the same. And it's very efficient. There are no obstructions. It's not free as in you won't be charged for it or it's not going to cost you anything. It's just free of obstruction. That's the real term of freeway. And by eliminating obstructions and limiting the access, the off and on ramps, you get a much more efficient flow.
So talk to me about the uniformity of the roads themselves. What is it that an interstate highway has to have in order to be an interstate highway?
It's a great point. And this whole system is a democracy in concrete and steel. It's amazing because it's a volunteer, profitable for the states venture where the states built their interstate systems with federal funding. The federal government didn't say, here's a check, go build it. They said, if you build it to our specifications, we will reimburse you. It's a big difference, right? So the states were motivated to build it as the feds wanted it, they did. And when they did do it correctly, they got their check, their reimbursement check for 90% of the cost. 10 cent dollars, the states were calling them in the 50s, 60s, 70s. But what does that look like? You know, the basics, it's a 12-foot travel lane, two of them always, no less than two in one direction, four lanes both ways. It's a 10-foot breakdown lane on the right. It's a 3-foot shoulder on the left. It's a green and white sign telling you where you're going, a brown and white one to find out where that national park is, and a blue and white one to tell you where there's a service ahead. It's a bridge that's not lower than 16 feet, so you can get underneath it if you have a Minuteman missile, ballistic missile you happen to be towing. Or that's the defensive aspect of the interstate system. And it's curvatures and gradients. It's gentle for the driver. And it's easy to see around corners because they're so unsharp. And all those things come together constantly over 47,000 miles of predictability.
So you just hit on one factor that I thought was really interesting in reading your book. And that's that the roads can't vary a lot in terms of their slope, which posed some real challenges when it came to crossing the Rocky Mountains.
You know, you just touched on what I think is the most interesting part of the interstate system from a factoid, a fun fact point. The highest point of the interstate system is underground in a tunnel over the Rocky Mountains at 11,000 plus feet going under the Continental Divide. I mean, they just nailed all these superlatives, all these engineering remarkable achievements at once when they built the Eisenhower Tunnel, aptly named after him. He loved Colorado. Mamie, his wife, was from Colorado. And the Eisenhower Tunnel was not going to even happen. I-70 was going to come across the great state of Kansas and dead end into Denver. And the Denver, Colorado coalition, congressmen, governor types went to Washington and said, no, we're going to take that line, that simple line, and drag it across Colorado. And that's what really developed Western Colorado.
You just mentioned one of the two great interstates that crisscrosses Kansas, I-70, as well as our other interstate, I-35. Tell me a little bit about those two interstate highways.
Isn't it amazing that we follow these numbers? And you can, you know, we all have GPS on our phone these days, but cross two interstates and you know right where you are. So I-35 and I-70, you know, that's Kansas. That is one of the great north-south highways. There are these great interstates, the great ones, the big ones, end in 0 or 5. And you have two of them. I-70 goes east and west, as the even numbers do, and I-35 goes north and south, as the odd-numbered ones do. Well, you can tell engineers laid out the system, right? And I-35 connects Canada with Mexico through the United States. It's this. If there's an interstate about commerce, it's probably I-35.
You just touched on one of the huge innovations in the interstate system, which was predictability and uniformity in the naming of the highways, which is something so basic, we just take it for granted. Probably many of us have never really given much thought to how our highways are numbered. But before the U.S. Interstate Highway System was developed in 1956, were roads just named whatever?
The Silk Road, or the National Road, or the Dixie Trail, and it goes on and on. And there was this love of roads being named, and these special names they felt gave that road, like the Lincoln Highway, special meaning. And when they decided to go to numbers in 1926, it was seen as a radical act. The federal government said, you know what, we're going to take all these dirt trails and we're going to name them with numbers. We're going to numerically lay out this interstate system. And it was a very large, very ambitious idea. And then in 1956, another interstate system was laid out with numbers as well. But that's why in the numbering system, you see the lowest numbers on the red, white, and blue shields in the southwest, San Diego. And they get higher as they go north and they go east to Maine, which has the highest number of the red, white, and blue interstate system shields. And the Route 66s, the U.S. routes, they began on the East Coast in 1926, so one runs up and down the East Coast. And then as they go west and as they go north, they get higher and higher in number. And that was a mirror image of each other just to keep them from being confusing. But those numbers really are so important for people. Once again, to the point of uniformity, people know where they are. And in 1903, there was not a map of the United States with roads on it. You had to make it up. And when Eisenhower went across the country in 1919 as part of the military convoy, I mean, this is a well-funded military adventure across the United States, really a big road trip. That's how Eisenhower saw it as a young lieutenant colonel, and he was excited to be on it. But they were looking for barns. They were looking for fences. They were looking for signs. They had to have on Indian and Harley-Davidson motorcycles scouts, usually U.S. Army Corps guys, go out ahead of the convoy to find the National Road, to find the Lincoln Highway, because it was not on maps. They had to explore and figure out where that road was. It was more in their minds and on paper than it was on the road, on the land. And now we have these roads that, even if you didn't have your GPS, you could find your way across the country.
Well, one of the organizations that was really key in helping people get from A to B was the AAA, which really sprang out of this need to figure out, how do I get from here to my destination?
I remember my grandfather had a AAA card and a sticker on his car. He loved it.
So did mine.
The triptych, and that was their brand, and that what made them famous. And I remember going down to the AAA office, hoping to get a bunch of maps that would take me to my destination. But you're right. In 1900, I think AAA was the first, if not one of the first, to lay out the country in roads. And you can imagine this association that is so big now. We're helping travelers. And it was fun, it was exciting, but it was also dangerous to go off into the hinterlands because you may not find your way back in time, at least not before supper. And these road maps eventually helped, and they got better and better. And the naming of the roads went to numbers as a further way to keep it simple.
What about the addition of the 100 numbers, like 270 or 435 that circles Kansas City? What's the pattern there?
The pattern is remarkable. If you look at the north, south, east, west, we're twice as long as we are wide. We're twice as long east, west as we are high, north, and south. And the numbers of the interstates, the odd numbers going north and south, there are 35 of them going across the country. The even ones are longer, like I-90 is 3,000 miles. That's the longest one in the system. And those odd numbers go north and south. The even ones go east and west. But then you have, in addition to those 62 superhighways that make up the interstate system, you have these spurs and loops. And the loops are ones that will bring you back to the interstate system if you leave it. So driving around a city, you often see a beltway. And if you're on it, it's going to end with an even number if it brings you back to the road that you were on. So if you're on 95 and you come across 495, you'll be sure that you'll get back to 95 eventually. If you see 195, beware, that's a spur that shoots you straight out to a destination but doesn't necessarily bring you back unless you backtrack. So the spurs, the belts, they all add into the system for a total of 47,000 miles.
Wow, that's a lot of highway.
It's a lot of highway, but it's only 2%, not even, of our total road system. We have about 4 million miles of road, and more than half of them are paved, which is a remarkable figure if you think through how many miles that is. And then the big road, as people call it, the truckers call it, the interstate system, the big road is less than 2%, but it handles 25% of the traffic. And it's so efficient that it keeps trucks, most probably undesirable vehicles, from city streets, from neighborhoods, and from the rural backcountry. Our popular roads, the ones that are so beautiful that people love to drive on, are one, wildly dangerous. They might be scenic, but they're dangerous and they're not as efficient. But because the traffic's on these efficient roads, the U.S. routes and the other blue highways in America have been preserved. It's really wonderful to think that that nasty traffic is on that big road that you like to complain about being boring.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because one of the challenges for people as they head down the road is the interaction between cars and trucks. Talk to me about sort of the tension between those two main groups of vehicles on our nation's highways.
That's interesting. Through conflict, there's clarity. The interstate system was really built for what Eisenhower was seeing, was to save lives, to build up our economic engines, and to defend the country. He was a genius to moving materials, especially in the Army, and his military convoys just were the awe of Khrushchev when he came to visit the United States. He was fascinated by how Eisenhower moved through Europe all these supplies. Eisenhower was about trucking, and trucking is really, I think, the real reason for the interstate systems. It's about commerce. The idea of us getting in our car and doing a road trip, that's fun. That's how most of us see the road. And the station wagon with the wood on the side and the kids packed up, that's kind of like the classic American vision of a road trip.
My mom had one of those.
My dad, too. And this is the beauty of it. But really, those trucks are what's really paying back the bills and the return on investment for the interstate system. They are, though, huge. They're 80,000 pounds. They pose a great risk to most people in their minds, maybe more than in reality. They're often driven by very professional drivers. But at 80,000 pounds, one truck passing over a bridge is the equivalent of, some have said, up to 10, 20, 30,000 cars. Cars are very light and cause almost no damage when they travel over the surface, but trucks put quite a burden on the road system and the bridges especially.
One of the things you delve into in your book, The Roads That Build America, is something that probably most of us don't really think much about, and that's what our roads are made of. The interstate system, roads are paved with asphalt. Talk to me about how that came to be and the development of the actual physical part of the roads.
You know, we were the last great empire to build roads in the 50s. That started with the Silk Road in China. It was the Roman road system. later the French, the Germans, and then it comes full circle back to the United States. They used almost every kind of material you can imagine. These were often just lines in the desert for the Silk Road. The Romans were famous for building a very deep road, and those roads still exist, and people love to say, well, if they built them like the Romans, they'd still be here. But if they built them like the Romans, we would have no more stone left on Earth. These roads were so deep and so burdensome. Financially, they were burdensome. What we learned later with the National Road in the United States is that we could use shells, we could use wood, we could use brick, we could use tar, we could use asphalt, we could use concrete. Almost any material that was hard was considered a possibility. We settled on asphalt. It's amazing. If you take a chunk of asphalt out of a road, you're looking at a 100-pound stone on your desk. Well, it's actually 5% glue. That's the asphalt, the black stuff. And then the 95 pounds would be stone. It's 5% asphalt, 95% stone. That is a typical road, but the asphalt is genius because it flexes, it moves, it's light. You don't need to go that deep into the earth. And maybe more importantly than its flexibility is its waterproofness. In road building, it's water, water, water. That is the killer. So it's all about drainage, drainage, drainage. But an asphalt road puts a perfect roof over a roadbed to keep it from getting damaged. And when there's a hole called a pothole, that will destroy your foundation. And that's what's so costly about potholes that are not treated.
Dan, your book about the interstate highway system is called The Roads That Built America, as opposed to The Roads That America Built.
Touche. It's interesting because it's a great American story about us all getting together and deciding to build this. If government is what we do together, infrastructure is what we build together, and this road system really links us. But once the system was built, that was a remarkable achievement. It was the largest engineering project in the history of the world at the time. But more remarkably, I think the system continues to give. It accelerates shipments. It allows precious goods to be shipped. It has reduced the cost of goods so everyone can afford the things that so few could afford in the past. And it's that ability to move about that it is so all-American that has let us interchange socially with each other. It's been a remarkable feature, both from an engineering point of view and from a socioeconomic point of view. And I think Eisenhower knew that he was going to be successful at this if he got it built, but I don't think even he could have guessed at the success he was going to have by building up our economy.
One of the things that the highway system really shaped in terms of our economy was how it helped create a whole industry of roadside services like Holiday Inn, Howard Johnson's, McDonald's, the things that people of my age remember on those road trips, that there were certain chains that you could find like Howard Johnson's that no matter where you were in the country, you'd be able to find one of those. Talk to me about how those were linked with the building of the interstate system.
The interstate system really brought all sorts of wonderful things and sometimes not so wonderful things to different parts of the country. But if you look at the South, I think it's a great example. In the South, they were very limited with roadside accommodations, and to have an interstate come down through the South meant you weren't on a tobacco road. You weren't wondering, is that a good place to stay? How's the food there? What's the bed going to be like at this hotel? The interstate system brought higher paying jobs, brought health benefits. It brought civil rights down to the South. Colin Powell is famous for saying, you know, when my family traveled, we stayed on the interstate because it was safe, because the Holiday Inns would allow black people to stay overnight, which wasn't the case in a lot of the establishments in the South at the time. So here you have all these wonderful things happening, but you have the owners of these big franchises like McDonald's and Holiday Inn flying over the interstates as they're being built in the 1950s and 60s, saying, there's going to be a really good location to put a hotel. There's going to be a great place for a restaurant. And then now we see huge Starbucks signs in Alabama saying, come here. It's along with that uniformity comes franchises. Franchises are all about uniformity. And you can kind of see this pattern going back and forth to the point now where we have to seek out originality.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I have a number of friends who don't like to travel on the interstate system because they like to take the back roads and find things that are more, I was going to say American, but just maybe more unique to a particular region or locale.
I think that's a really important distinction because I driving my old car, I drove a 1949 Hudson all around the country, promoting infrastructure and the road system, talking about it. And to do that, the interstate system is gentle, so the car could climb easier. You know, wasn't surprised by bad pavement usually, but then we'd peel off. My partner and I, we would peel off and we would look for roadside greasy spoons, because those are the fun places to go. That's where you really see Americana, and that's where you see and can speak to people without that kind of intensity or that rush that you have when you're at a roadside interstate highway rest stop.
You wrote your book about the interstate system back in 2006 when it was the 50th anniversary of the system. Update us a bit since then. What kind of challenges do we face today? What has the past 10 years meant in terms of what our interstate highway system looks like?
Well, you know, when I came to Kansas City yesterday, I cracked open the paper and I thought, that's fascinating and tragic. I see a car flipped over on the side of the road, a fatality. Someone had come off 435, I believe. And then in the lower other corner, you see driverless cars coming, another article, separate article. But the two are linked. When you think about driverless cars, I think of horseless carriages. You know, it was seen as so strange to have this carriage, which was exactly what it was, with a motor in it instead of a horse on it. And now we're looking at cars that will drive themselves, that do drive themselves. And I think that's the future. I think these big roads that we have are land banks. I think these big roads are opportunities for other forms of transportation. The road and the car is a great model, has been a great model. But what will that look like in the future? With driverless cars, we may need far fewer of them. So that could be an 80% reduction in some people's opinion about how many cars we'll see on the road, because it'll be so efficient. Most of us only use our car 5% of the time. So if that car was constantly in use, you would need fewer of them, and ride sharing would become commonplace. And it's also considered to be much safer. So this highway, this interstate, it's already carrying utilities, it's already carrying trucks and cars, but soon they might be driverless cars, soon there might be high-speed trains running down them, soon there might be other modes of transportation running underneath them, on them, above them, like drones delivering packages.
Dan, how did you get interested in the subject of roads and highways?
My dad, in the back of the station wagon on summer vacations, you know, going on and on about the building of the interstate system and what they were all about. I come from a family of road builders, so it was conversation that we never stopped having. And I think it kind of bled into this obsession, almost manic at times, about roads. But I think what's so exciting about it, it's always social, Kay. It's always social. It's always a social political discussion about what we choose to build and where we go and why we do it. The roads are remarkable, but it's that social intercourse that takes place along those roads that I think is the most stunning part about the system and how we went all came together to build it, that great model of democracy.
Dan, if you could change one thing about our highway system, what would it be?
The usage. I would love to see bikes. You know, I do a lot of biking, and in fairness to everybody, when you're a pedestrian, you look at the bicyclists with a hairy eye, and then the cars look at the bicyclists and the pedestrians. You know, but whoever you are at that whatever given moment, bicycles. I mean, that was kind of the beginning of the good road movement. These bicyclists were going out further before cars came on the scene in a big way, and I just think there's a great opportunity to put bikes along roads. The interstate system wouldn't allow it at first. Now they're starting to allow it, and trains. I think if we could get a high-speed train running between Kansas and St. Louis, if we could get high-speed trains to take up that right-of-way, and the land, it's so valuable. It's that path that we now have that we should put to better use.
One of the ways in which our highways are not necessarily uniform is the use of toll roads on many of our interstate system. Talk to me about how the toll roads developed and how they play into accessibility and the use of our roads.
The tolls, it's interesting. It was the bane of the road system at the beginning. They were seen as blockades to commerce because people privately built bridges and then would gouge people trying to get across them. So it was a big movement and success when the federal government finally said, you know what, we're not going to allow these structures to be tolled and owned privately. Now we're looking at things a little bit differently. But the short story is, when they decided to build the interstate system in 1956, some states had already started to build their interstate system roads along those exact lines that were going to be designated as the interstate system, like Pennsylvania, famously, the granddaddy of turnpikes. And they said, fairly, well, we've already paid for our road. We already built it with our own money. Everyone else is getting their roads built by federal money. What are we going to do? And the federal government said, we're going to let you keep your tolls up. So there are toll booths along the interstate system, which does not allow for tolling, except on these Pennsylvania turnpikes, these New York throughways, these tolled structures before the interstate system. Everything old is new. We're coming back to it. People don't want to raise the gas tax in Washington. So what are we going to do? We're going to see a lot more tolling. And that ownership, that private ownership in public space is starting to creep back in. And that could be a good thing. It might not be on the road, but it's coming. And I see tolls, trucks, and tunnels as the future of the interstate system. And trucks will be paying their fair share, as they always have. But we're going to see a lot more electronic tolling, which is highly efficient, a lot less painful. And that's how I think we're going to pay for our road system in the future.
Of course, Kansas does have a toll road, the Kansas Turnpike. At least one person was not happy with the opening of the Kansas Turnpike. Tell me the story about Amos Switzer.
Amos, the angry farmer that was probably just a really nice guy, but he had his farm right in there in Oklahoma at the end of the Kansas Turnpike. The Kansas Turnpike dead-ended into his field, and famously, Life magazine featured him in an article showing the Kansas Turnpike screaming down through Kansas and then coming to this stop. Amos supposedly hooked up a tractor and cars and ditched them out at 500 a year, at the rate of 500 a year. And I think it was the governor of Wyoming and his wife were road tripping down, as neophytes did back then, storming down the interstate system, the turnpike, the Kansas Turnpike, and they blasted through his barrier. He had to fish them out of his farm. But that was a perfect example of the feds getting involved in the road building business. And this is, you know, Ike's hometown, home state. He knew that the states couldn't build these roads together. It was Oklahoma's idea to build that turnpike. Kansas had the money, so they went ahead and did it. So this is a great idea. Let's get connected to Texas and Canada. And then Kansas never thought that Oklahoma wouldn't get their act together. Oklahoma never built their road. And so we had a dead end. We had a superhighway coming to a screaming halt right in Amos's field. And he was, I think, the perfect picture of why we needed to do this on a national level.
It seems like such an obvious thing that we needed this. And it's easy in hindsight to say, well, of course we needed an interstate system. But at the time, was this controversial?
Oh, I wildly controversial. The controversy around the interstate system really stems from people not knowing what they needed or what they wanted. But knowing that they wanted to get into their new car with a full tank of gas and go somewhere and go fast. And the cars at the time just weren't ready for those high speeds. But as we saw in the Pennsylvania Turnpike, when they opened up this Autobahn, because it was an exact model of the Autobahn then, and people put their cars on, their Buicks and their Chevys and their other cars, they were driving at 70, 80 miles an hour in third gear. And that will destroy a car very quickly.
Yeah.
But people didn't also know that by limiting the access to and from the road, you'd have a much more efficient flow. Farmers were wondering, well, my house and my barn are going to be separated. They were the victims of progress, sadly. But people understood eventually that, one, the road was much safer divided. Two, that if you had less access, you'd actually get more speed. And three, you know, the idea of these wide roads. Eisenhower brilliantly came along at that moment and said, no, we're not going to improve the U.S. routes, a little bit here, a little bit there, eliminating a grade crossing, eliminating a curve. We're going to build a greenfield project, meaning a brand new project from the bottom up, and we're going to lay down right next to the existing interstates these big wide roads. And instead of these small improvements, he did one big improvement. People thought, understandably, that, well, you're repeating yourself. You're just creating a redundant system. But no, they're remarkably different. And those U.S. routes now serve a much more local purpose, while the interstate serves a true interstate function.
That's fascinating. I mean, I knew that. You know, like anybody that spends any time, it's never occurred to me that, like, oh, that actually, that makes sense that there's a redundancy there.
It's like getting all the wires straight behind your TV, right? Like, it just, yeah, it makes perfect sense when you figure out the flow. But from a social economic perspective, people thought, well, if they create a free road next to this road that's a toll road, we're going to have a problem. And even then, you see an equal split. You know, truckers will pay a little bit more to get going across the state of Indiana, and maybe won't take those local roads, even though they exist right next to it.
You mentioned that our interstate system is based on the Autobahn in Germany. Are there things that we could learn from highway systems in other countries?
It's fascinating to me to see how we exchange information. I've done a lot of traveling in China and met with Chinese officials about the road system they were building. And they were taking the best ideas from the U.S. interstate system, and they told me, and the best ideas from the Autobahn, and they've combined them into what I'm calling the interprovincial system. It's not an interstate system. It's an interprovincial system in China, 30 provinces being bound together with these superhighways. But like a Louis Vuitton handbag, they have copied our interstate system brilliantly and wonderfully. And this is the free flow of exchange. That's why I love transportation. That kind of information is for them to take and to do even a better job of. I think we can now learn from what they've done, what the Germans are doing, and improve our system a whole lot.
Dan, thank you so much for talking to me about this.
Okay, I've loved it. Thanks for having me.
Dan McNichol is the author of The Roads That Built America, the incredible story of the U.S. interstate system. We spoke last year at the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. This weekend, Topeka is celebrating what would have been the 100th birthday of Topeka native and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gwendolyn Brooks. One of the special guests at Brooks Fest was Elizabeth Farnsworth. You may know her from Public Television's NewsHour, where she has reported from Cambodia, Haiti, Saudi Arabia, and Chile. But before she became a globe-trotting journalist, she was a Kansas native. Farnsworth has written a memoir about her experiences and the way they connect to her childhood in Topeka. She talked this week with KPR's Laura Lorson about her unusual sense of storytelling and how her memoir reflects that.
I never really wanted to write a memoir. I think that as journalists, we don't want to talk about ourselves. At the NewsHour, we were to shine the spotlight on the person whose story we were telling. So I didn't have any desire to write a memoir, but I had this strange experience one day while editing at Skywalker Ranch outside San Francisco, and I started writing everything down that followed from that, and it became a book.
When exactly did you start working for the NewsHour?
My first story for the NewsHour was from Guatemala in 1984. It aired in 1984. I actually did it in 1983, but they sat on it for a while.
Uh-huh. And how did you come to be in Guatemala?
I was making a film for KQED. I'd started working in 83 for KQED as a freelance producer and on-air correspondent.
Now, you're originally from Topeka.
I am. I left Topeka when I went to college. I came back in the summer, but never really lived in Topeka again. I love living in Topeka, but something just took me away. Mm-hmm. I went to Stanford Graduate School, and then my husband and I got married, and we lived in various places, ending up in California.
Would you say that being a Kansas native informed some of the stories that you chose to do? I think being from Kansas is a very particular thing, and you sort of take that Kansas mentality with you when you go, if you're from here.
I think so, too. I'm glad you asked about that, because I think the memoir is a lot about my growing up in Topeka. It is, in fact, partly about a tragedy in my family when I was young, and I used the train trip that I took with my father after that to talk about both the tragedy and also to try to explore how that affected my reporting from dangerous places. But it's wider than just the fact that it's about my childhood. I think that who we are, those of us that are from Kansas, is very much determined by being a Kansan. For example, I think not wanting to talk about ourselves is very Kansan. And I have various theories for why that's the case. One is a kind of natural modesty that I think is furthered in Kansas, but I think weather, strangely enough, has to do with it too. How can you think you're very important when these enormous forces of weather, this enormous prairie, the unpredictability of what will happen in the weather is always with you. And I think it influenced, at least it influenced me.
It's a memoir, yet it's not a memoir. It's got elements of magical realism to it. Obviously, that really appeals to you. You've reported from Latin America. How did you get drawn to that kind of literature and that kind of storytelling?
Well, thank you. I mean, I think it's a very strange book. I'm surprised anybody wants to read it. It's so strange. But fortunately, people are wanting to read it. I can't even explain why I, for example, have a part of the book where I break into fiction. My imagination just took over and I couldn't stop from making up part of it. And I am open about that. But if you ask me about magical realism, I wouldn't have even thought that that was in the book. But I think imagination is one way to see the world that is honest in many ways. And I think it's a way to express reality in a way that the mind and the soul can both take. So yes, I like magical realism.
I think you have to be incredibly grounded in realist realism to be able to really manage writing in that style.
Yes, and actually both García Márquez and Mario Vargas Llosa, they have been journalists and they're also novelists. In some ways, the only way that they could express the depths and the heights of it was to use their imagination to do it. That's what gave birth to magical realism in some ways.
Mm-hmm. You're going to give this talk in Topeka. Say a teenager comes to you and says, oh my gosh, I want to tell stories like that too. What would you tell that kid to do?
I'd tell them to trust their imagination. I'd tell them if they want to be a journalist, I'd tell them to learn how to rigorously research and report stories. I mean, really rigorously. I would advise them to learn a very careful use of language, and I would urge this person to let their imagination take over once in a while.
That's Elizabeth Farnsworth speaking to KPR's Laura Lorson. Farnsworth's new memoir is called A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined. She's in Topeka this weekend for Brooksfest. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
So sorry, please accept my apology. But love was blind, and I was too blind to see.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. They may be the two hardest words in the English language and two of the most powerful. For the rest of this hour, the apology. Dr. Harriet Lerner of Lawrence is one of America's most respected experts on relationships and the best-selling author of The Dance of Anger. Her latest book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. Welcome, Dr. Lerner.
I'm delighted to be here.
You have 45 years as a practicing therapist under your belt. Why did you think that this book needed to be written?
The apology is so important because we're all connected. We all screw up. We're imperfect human beings. We always will unwittingly hurt people just as we are hurt by them. So the need to both give and receive apologies is with us till our very last breath. And if done correctly, an apology is deeply healing. And if the apology is absent, or it's a bad apology, it actually can put a crack in the very foundation of a relationship, or it can end the relationship.
Speaking of bad apologies, one of the things you talk about in your book is that it's not enough to just say, I'm sorry. We have to get it right. Why is it so hard to get that right?
Because it's so easy to get it wrong. Maybe we should talk about the key ways that we muck up the apology, because if we're aware of that, it can help put us on track. So the number one offender is the word, but. I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you were provoking me. Right. Or I'm sorry that I forgot the meeting, but I was totally snowed under with work. It doesn't matter if what you say after the but is true. It makes the apology false. So get your butt out of your apology. No pun intended. And then another way we ruin apologies, which is a little more subtle, is we apologize for the other person's reactions rather than for our own behavior. Like if I said, I'm really sorry that you were upset that I corrected your stories at the party. That's not an apology. I'm sorry you feel that way. It wasn't my intention to hurt you. That's not an apology.
I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings.
Or if, right. And the apology would be, I'm sorry that I corrected your stories at the party. You had told me that you didn't like that. I was wrong. And I won't do it again. And then, of course, you know, here's a very obvious thing. But if we apologize with a grand flourish, and then we repeat the very thing that we apologize for, of course, it's totally empty.
It should come to no surprise to any male-female couple that there are real gender differences on how or whether we say, I'm sorry. I catch myself saying, I'm sorry all the time. Many of my emails start out, I'm sorry for the delay getting back to you. Sorry I missed your call. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. What is that all about?
Well, I was, you know, my generation of women was certainly raised to feel guilty if we were anything less than an emotional service station to others, and guilty for using up valuable oxygen in the room. And it is true that one risk factor for being an under-apologizer is to be raised male. And the greatest risk for being an over-apologizer is to be raised female. So many women will identify with what you're saying, like, oh, I'm so sorry. You were about to speak. I didn't mean to interrupt you. And, oh, you were going to sit here. I'm so sorry. And the problem with the endless streams of I'm sorrys is that whatever the cause, it's good to tone it down. So if you've forgotten to return your friend's Tupperware, don't apologize numerous times as if you've run over her kitten. Over-apologizing creates distance. It interrupts the flow of normal conversation. It will irritate your friends who have to stop and reassure you, like, no, no, don't worry about it, rather than talk about what they want to talk about. I will say, though, that this habitual sort of self-effacing girl thing it's not at the heart of what we're talking about. Because when it comes to a real apology for a serious injury and what that demands of us, the demand to really accept responsibility without a hint of evasion or excuse making or blaming, the capacity to listen without defensiveness, this challenge crosses gender and culture and age and all of the filters through which we see reality. So it's really a basic human challenge.
My kids are grown now, but when they were young, I remember breaking up disputes between them and usually ending with a, tell your sister you're sorry. What's a better way to teach kids how to apologize?
Well, there's nothing wrong for asking for an apology if it's merited. So if we think an apology is due, there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying to our child, you know, I'd like you to apologize. The problem is that parents do not know how to say thank you for the apology. I really appreciate it, and stop there. So what parents do that make children absolutely allergic to apologizing is they say, thank you for the apology, but I really wish that I didn't have to ask you for it three times. Or thank you for the apology, but I don't feel it was really sincere and you were looking at your feet and you go to your room and you think about how you hurt your brother's feelings and you come back and you give a really genuine apology. And I've done the research on this, and it makes kids want to stick their fingers in their ears and just get away. And it's really interesting how difficult it is for parents to say, thank you for the apology. I really appreciate it. Keep in mind, this is true for kids or adults, the apology isn't the end of the conversation. In other words, the parent we're talking about can open up the conversation again if there's more they want their child to think about. The apology isn't the end of the conversation. The apology is what lowers the intensity and creates an emotional climate that further conversation can occur later. And, you know, I always, anyone who gets me as a therapist, Kay, gets me as a an editor. And I always tell people to say it shorter because we tend to over-talk things. And, I mean, I was certainly guilty of that. I remember conversations with my younger son, Ben, about cleaning up the public space. And I would be lecturing him. I would go on, and his brain waves would be flat, and his eyes would be rolling back in his head. And even though I didn't have his attention, I would keep going. So it sounds like very simple advice to say to our children, thank you for the apology. Nothing more. It's actually very difficult.
It's very difficult, not just in your relationships with your children. Accepting an apology, in a way, it's almost like accepting a compliment. It can be very hard to just open yourself up to that moment and just accept what that person has to give you.
Yeah, an example of that is my friend was having a dinner party, and one of her friends who she invited had just come back from a trip around Europe and talked endlessly, unceasingly, about his travels without leaving space for other people and without asking questions to other people. And my friend, by the way, after the dinner party was over, told me how obnoxious she felt this was. But when he called her, when he had the integrity and maturity and courage to call her the next day and apologize for being a conversation hog, as he put it, she said, oh, no, no, you know, we were all very interested in your stories. Don't worry about it. It was fine. And out of her own discomfort in the moment, she canceled the apology that indeed he knew was due, and that's why he called to apologize. So it can be hard.
In your book, Why Won't You Apologize?, you relay a really powerful story of a woman who accepts an apology from you, an incident involving some M&Ms, which I found it really got to the heart of that. Can you relay that story to us?
I was at the airport, and this is back when my kids were little, and there was a problem with the car rental, and a lot of us ended up in the airport floor, and I gave a bag of candy. I opened a bag of candy for my two little boys, and I saw this little girl next to me looking longingly at it, and I simply handed her the open bag and offered it to her, and she took a handful. And I became slightly uncomfortable because it occurred to me that I hadn't asked her mother. And at first, I wasn't going to apologize because the mother seemed to have no reaction and time passed, it seemed silly to apologize. But I decided to apologize. And I said, I'm sorry that I offered your daughter candy without asking you first. And I was sure she was going to say, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. It's nothing. And instead, she looked me in the eye and really held the connection and said in a very present way, thank you for the apology. I really appreciate it. And what she didn't do was equally as important. She didn't lecture me. She didn't say, don't you know that your boy's dirty hands have been on the floor and then in the candy? She didn't say, you know, my child could have been diabetic. I mean, all of these things are true. And it was the simplicity and her grace of simply saying, thank you for the apology. I appreciate it. That really made me realize that I did have something to apologize for. And also became my role model that I try to teach parents of how to accept an apology in that way.
Dr. Lerner, in your book, Why Won't You Apologize?, you gave two pieces of advice that really stuck with me. The first, say it shorter. You've already talked about.
Right.
The second was, your apology is not about you.
Right. A real apology is not, a real apology is to soothe the hurt party. It's to help the hurt party feel safe and soothed in the relationship again, and to let them know that we care about their feelings and that we're capable of taking responsibility for what we've said or done or not said or done. It's not about getting something back, like forgiveness, although we might hope for that. And it's not about lowering our own guilt quotient, although that happens. And it's not something that we're only going to do if the other person owns up to their part, because if we've apologized for our 40%, then they should really apologize for their 60%. That's not what an apology is about. It's about that you take unequivocal, clear responsibility for your own behavior, because that is the highest ground that you can stand on, even if the other person is defensive about their part.
Dr. Harriet Lerner is the author of Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. Dr. Lerner, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
So sorry that I was such a fool. I didn't know love could be so cruel. Oh, 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 yeah. You tell me mistake. A part of the alien, but that don't right the wrong that's been done. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
So sorry.
So sorry. Please accept my apology, but love is blind.